Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the second program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM Community Radio. Our conversation today is about the continuing constitutional crisis. What does civic courage look like in these times? We'll talk about civic courage and neighborliness, how they create solidarity under stress, how communities under pressure are holding it together in Minneapolis, in Maine, and in other communities around the country. What do we have in common with pro-democracy resistance movements around the world? This show was pre-recorded on February 16th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum today. Let me introduce our guests. Oliver Kaplan is Associate Professor, the Joseph Corbell School of Global and Public Affairs at the University of Denver. He is this semester a visiting scholar at Stanford University Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. Welcome, Oliver.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Amy Dubeck. Amy is a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Castine, who visited Minneapolis in their recent travails. Welcome, Amy. Can't wait to hear your story.
Thank you for asking me to be here. It's great.
And Julia Edwards works with SOPO, South Portland Helps Mutual Aid Network. Julia, thank you for joining us as well.
You're so welcome. I'm glad to meet you all. I wish I was under different circumstances.
Right. So let's get started. Oliver, I want to put the first question to you. You've been an observer of resistance movements around the world, now from Los Angeles, Portland, Oregon, Chicago, Minneapolis, and even now Portland, Maine. In Lewiston, Maine, American cities are having to learn the lessons of resistance. Tell us what you've observed about some of those key lessons.
Yeah, I think what we've been seeing in the U.S. has been really interesting, especially for someone like me who's largely been an international observer, to now see certain actions unfolding in the U.S. under very difficult conditions. And, you know, just to state the obvious, what we've been seeing is a lot of protests and a lot of community action across these different cities as immigration enforcement has ramped up. And we've also been seeing an evolution of approaches from city to city. I think if you'll remember over the summer, there was the National Guard in Los Angeles and things. At some moments, there were like larger protests, a little more hectic in some cases. And I think people have seen different movements over time where there's been more focused responses by the public, greater discipline. What I've seen, I wrote a short piece in this outlet called The Conversation a few weeks ago, where I was comparing international actions that I've seen from communities in war zones around the world with some of the actions that we're seeing in the United States now. The Americans have been learning essentially lessons that international communities have also learned over time. And I think these are some of the four short main lessons that I would point to. One, I think we're seeing that people are embracing the idea that nonviolent action is effective. So people through, you know, mobilizing peacefully, going out on the streets, finding unity together, they can make a difference. And I think, you know, it's not always easy. It doesn't work every single time, but I think people are seeing results, and I think that's important. I think people are also learning different protection strategies and different protection approaches, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Probably the most important thing that people are seeing is the importance of getting organized at the community level, at a larger level in the city, building those ties and seeing the power that comes from those social ties and that level of organization. And then I think lastly, what people are seeing is that, you know, the power of the people will outlast these conditions. And I think people are, you know, it's very difficult. I'm sure we're going to hear about Minneapolis and how cold and challenging those conditions were. But, you know, people stood fast and they've been able to endure. And I think that's a really important outcome as well.
communities that are responding. Now, take just Minneapolis, for example. I mean, I had read that they were doing nonviolence training basically years since the George Floyd thing. Have you heard that too, Oliver?
I've heard that, yeah. So I think that that kind of training in the background is important, but I think it's never too late to start that kind of training, to learn, to go out with friends and you know, and understand how these things work.
Amy, tell us the story of how you got invited to Minneapolis and what you saw when you got there.
A call went out from a group called MARCH, Multi-Faith Anti-Racism Change and Healing. There are a lot of organizations that are doing trainings, but MARCH was offering trainings for clergy. And the UUA, Unitarian Universalist Association, has a kind of a sidearm called Side with Love. And they sent an invite out that any UU clergy or clergy in process were invited to come to a training on Thursday the 22nd that would train us for action.
What month was that?
January 22nd.
Okay, go ahead. Yep.
And action on the 23rd. And the action was specifically an invitation from Minnesotans who have been in the streets working, asking for some help, some backup, because we were taught that you are revolutionary with a schedule, that you take some breaks, and sometimes you got to step back. So they were asking us to come in.
Had you had nonviolence training before?
I have, but I've been in ministry for almost 30 years.
Uh-huh.
So I had, but my 22-year-old daughter wanted to go too. So there was nonviolence training. Oliver, I love everything that you said, and I would just say, what we learned in Minneapolis were all four of the things you said under the umbrella of get to know your neighbors. Get to know your neighbors in ways that you haven't yet. And that's probably the biggest nonviolence that you can do, is get to know your neighbors so that when somebody is being taken by ICE, that isn't the moment that you find out about them.
Mm-hmm. So when you got to Minneapolis, how did you and your group sort of slot into what was already going on out there?
That was new for me. I'm a small town minister of a small church, and we were told, I already use Signal. I already went off of other platforms, so I already use Signal, but we were told to completely take it off your phone before you get there. We were told to find pods of people, both physical and in Signal groups. And within those pods, we change our names. This is along the safety thing. It was a lot for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been doing vigils and protests and marches and since I was a kid. But this was new. The idea that they have sophisticated surveillance and that they're using it against American citizens was new. And really, it was scary for me.
And what was the role of the clergy?
To be a non-anxious presence. To help de-escalate the big feelings that people have, to hold the situation in prayer. This was not a just Unitarian Universalist thing. Hold everybody in prayer, de-escalate when possible, witness. I went specifically so that I could see what was going on, learn about things I didn't know, and bring it back.
Mm-hmm. And here you are, bringing it back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Juliet, tell us your experience and how you got involved.
Sure. So I live in South Portland, Maine. We're just like a couple miles, not even from Portland, which saw a really huge increase in activity. But I believe we are the second highest in terms of number of people that were kidnapped and or detained. So we have a fairly diverse community here. We have five elementary schools, a middle school, and a high school. And so when the rumor started, and it was literally just a snippet on the internet, on I think it was on Blue Sky that I saw it, but an activist that I follow said, you know, sources are saying that ICE is coming, so get ready. No information other than that. And that one caused a lot of fear and panic. That was the first thing. And then it immediately sent a number of us throughout the Southern Maine and Maine in general area to get organized. But for me and my experience and the group that I am a part of, it's it purely happened because a couple, I'll say moms, texted and were like, hey, like, do you want to be a part of this group to figure out what to do? And you never really know how you're going to react in moments of like trauma or crisis or something scary coming. And I'm glad my answer was yes, because then we started talking stupidly over like iMessage at first. And then we quickly realized, okay, we need to flip over to Signal. So we all learned how to use Signal. Most of us had never even had that app before. And so it started with, you know, maybe 5 or 6 of us, and it very quickly ballooned into a network of about, like, we think about 300 to 400 people. Wow. We're not totally sure because the secrecy is the key, and for safety and other reasons and effectiveness. We started with just a very core small group, and it literally was built based on who we knew and who we trust and who we could like look in the eye and say, okay, they're trustworthy. I would trust them with my kids. We're just going to go based on the trust method. And that's all we have to go on, because we do not have access to vetting records and backgrounds. And we're not a staff that can vet social media feeds. And we tried to just go based on trust and faith. And it so far has worked out pretty well from as far as we can tell. But it was incredibly, it was like a fire hose shooting like holes through a wall, and we were just trying to plug all the holes with like our tiny fingers. If that's a very weird metaphor, but
so what was the nature of the activities that you were engaged in?
Yeah, so we kind of started to think about, okay, we need to meet, what are the basic needs first? One, food; two, get kids to school; three, get people to work; four, try to figure out, you know, access to healthcare, either not missing medical appointments or getting home visits or telehealth, getting access to resources to help with if you do lose income because you are afraid to leave your home, talking with landlords, talking with, you know, anybody that could provide some very immediate emergency relief. So that was our primary focus. So we were giving rides to anybody and everybody that expressed fear for literally leaving their homes. I particularly, in the beginning, I gave rides. We kind of buddied up. So we would try to buddy with families that were just, our phone number would get out there and people would just start sharing it and asking for help. And so then we'd transition them to Signal and try to do everything by voice to keep people's privacy. We then connected with our school department so that we could reach families that had kiddos in the school. We found that the majority of students who were not in school, the weeks where the increased activity was most horrific, are students of color. And so we were trying to get them resources to deliver, you know, their books and bring the iPads. I took kids to school, picked them up, took them to their gymnastics so they didn't have to miss that, took parents to work, picked parents up from work. The biggest wake up for me in all of that was, oh my goodness, like they feel instantly safer. These people are giving me care of their children because they feel safer having them walk from their door to my car 15 feet because of who I am and I would argue the color of my skin. So, but we did everything and we're doing everything from, you know, the rides, the food delivery, anything specific that people need to feel a little bit normal, things that kiddos need, supplies, tampons, pads, you know, any feminine care products that people might not want to ask for. We're now engaged in rent relief, so to avoid evictions for people. We cleaned off cars when we had a massive snowstorm, like in the thick of the activity, and people were afraid to go out of their door to clean off their cars. So we organized like car cleanup and snow removal. It was just people showing up like, hey, if you can be here at this time, at this like random location, just see a bunch of white people shoveling.
Let me take a short station break here and we'll come back, okay? You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is about the continuing constitutional crisis. What does civic courage look like now? Our guests this afternoon are Amy DeBeck, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Castine, Julia Edwards, whom you just heard from, who is with the South Portland Helps Mutual Aid Network, and Oliver Kaplan, associate professor in the Joseph Corbell School of Global and Public Affairs at the University of Denver. This program was pre-recorded on February 16th. No listener calls are being taken. So from what you were just hearing, Oliver, how much in common is Maine having with the experience of other communities that you've observed around the country and around the world, actually?
Yeah, well, just reacting to what both Amy and Julia said, I think one of the key things they're both doing is what happens a lot in international communities, which is called international accompaniment. So literally, you know, other bodies of different backgrounds walking with, just being alongside people who are at risk and fulfilling various roles. I mean, the literature and scholarship and humanitarian reports call this sort of unarmed bodyguard, which is basically, you know, being there for someone, helping them get around safely, being an extra set of eyes for what's happening. And this is crucial. I mean, my co-panelists here are playing really important roles just by showing up and being available. And, you know, it's a sad statement, but, you know, different demographic characteristics and ascriptive characteristics right now mean that, you know, the enforcement that's happening is indiscriminate in a sense, and yet still sort of focused on certain types of populations. And so the people who are sort of less vulnerable, I think, can play that role of stepping up and assisting. And I think that's a really important lesson. And we see that in communities in Latin America, in the Middle East, in Africa, where, you know, it'd be, let's say, someone from a Western country who looks different, who has access to different networks internationally, can push out information, can bring additional technical assistance and advise them on how to implement best practices for safety and protection. And so I think, you know, it's in fact, just like what Amy said, you know, like sometimes even the volunteers have to step back. Well, that's the same for people on the ground. You know, if they're in a situation like this 24/7, they need, you know, some backstopping and assistance. In Colombia, I observed the International Committee of the Red Cross as they were accompanying different communities and got to see this firsthand in conflict zones. So
I imagine for some of these communities where there's a sort of a surprise, like they haven't actually had the chance to prepare. But as we've seen these actions sort of roll from community to community to community, you know, we're having a little bit more time to prepare. And so, for example, I had heard that the ACLU of Maine had done a Know Your Rights webinar when we heard ICE was coming in that was attended by 1,000 people. Now, Maine is not a very big state. Just have 1,000 people turn out for a training like that. So, I mean, I'm just curious. So there's the Know Your Rights stuff and there's training in nonviolence. You know, maybe there's training in how to be secure online, stuff like that. But is this the kind of stuff that communities gen up on the threat, or is the kind of thing that, for example, Minneapolis has been doing this for a few years because of their George Floyd history? What happens generally, would you say, Oliver, as communities try to get prepared for something like this?
Yeah, well, I don't want to make blanket statements because I think it varies a lot. And I think even in Minneapolis, you know, there were some people that were training and a lot that were still probably taken by surprise. And I, you know, one thing I've been thinking about a lot is sort of the power of surprise. I think for a lot of people who are getting mobilized now, this, even if you knew it was coming and took a training, it's still a surprise when it's happening in front of you. But I think on the other hand, people shouldn't be surprised about what they can do and what they're capable of. And I think sort of that's also a really important thing to keep in mind. And I think, you know, what I've seen internationally is the kind of armed actors, the insurgents, the paramilitaries, the military, they're often surprised by citizen responses that they're not expecting when there's a nonviolent protest, when people come out to call out their actions. Often they've never thought this could happen. They thought they were in power And they're almost as shocked as anyone else to see people sort of opposing their rule, opposing what they're doing. So I think that's just sort of an important, point to keep in mind, that there's sort of surprise all around in some sense. And what that means is that there's also capability. So I'd say sort of like don't make assumptions. But I think the training, it really varies. One of the things I've seen is from country to country, different countries, but like Colombia, Philippines, even some other countries, these communities will form networks with each other, and they'll start sharing best practices and uniting and coming, to the aid. One community will travel to another community to backstop them. I've participated in some of these events myself and seen sort of, a cross-cutting group of like, Afro-Colombian, indigenous, mestizo, farmer Colombians, for example, from all over the country. They're all in one place to sort of raise awareness. And so I think the training can happen at any time. I think it's better to do it, ahead of time and have those networks in place. But I think what, people are learning, and I think, my sort of background takeaway is that this learning is really important for Americans, both for what's happening here, but also I think we should be raising our awareness about, what we can do to support communities abroad now that we understand it, in a new way at home.
So, Amy, you were in the protest side of it. Like, Julia was talking about the mutual aid side, and I know that's one super important role that community groups can play. But you were asked to really stand in protest, right? When you went to Minneapolis?
Clergy was. Here's my takeaway. I ride a mobility scooter. I knew going in that I was not going to be a drain on the people around me, where the battery was going to freeze and I wasn't going. So I knew that going in and immediately found ahead of time other things I could be doing. And even when, we all enjoy those photos, that enjoy, but we saw the photos of the 100 clergy being arrested at the airport. They went into that even before all of these anti-ICE movements. All of the peaceful demonstrations I've done, all of the nonviolent direct action I've done has included people who know that it would be okay for them to get arrested. And so when you see somebody getting arrested and they're not expecting it, that really is a terrible surprise, because just as ICE has their specific modes of getting things done, so do we. And we train to make sure that those things happen as expected. So we wouldn't be putting somebody in the front line who couldn't handle that.
I'm really interested to ask you a little bit more about the different roles and the different risk levels that people may go into this with, and how organizers find the right place for the right person who's got the right risk tolerance. Talk a little bit more about that, Amy.
Every American has a responsibility at this time. And so all of us have to find what that responsibility can be. And so if your responsibility is to keep up the phone calling and the letter writing, that's important. And if the responsibility is to run down to Portland from Castine and give some rides, do that. As a religious leader, this is what I have really worked on, is figuring out how to help people not feel so powerless. And it's definitely a work in progress. Being asked to be on calls like this is helpful, because I think that we're all trying to figure out what is it that we can do. Having trainings for ICE observers, observations. Some people are going to be too scared to do that. And other people are going to just fall into it naturally.
Some people are willing to get arrested, and some people would rather not.
And one of the things I learned that has just really stuck with me is that there's a difference between getting arrested and getting detained. That ICE doesn't go through due process. And so if you're going into a situation where the people you're going to come up against are ICE, there's not a lot that you can prepare for. When you're going to do a march, when you're going to do a vigil, and you know that the city or county or state police are going to be there, then you're looking at due process, being arrested, being and so the mutual aid stuff, I'm sure, Julia, you're going to, if it hasn't already started, some of the things that Minneapolis has been doing that we have to learn about is that when they let detainees go, it might be in the middle of the night with no phone, no clothes,
transportation.
No transportation.
100%.
So, yeah. So it morphs into all kinds of ways to provide nonviolent direct action. So, you know, if somebody's jam is not necessarily being in a protest, they could be on patrol picking people up when they get out. So there's talk about everyone.
I see Julia nodding. Go ahead, talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I had some experiences with instances like that. In general, I want to back up a minute because what Reverend DeBeck said was really interesting about people like picking their lane and figuring out what they're good at. For us, we found one of the big challenges to grapple with was so many people wanted to do so many things and had the wherewithal and the personality for multiple things. And we had to really be intentional in the beginning of setting, okay, if you are going to work with our community members who are the most threatened and vulnerable, you cannot also be out there where your face is out there, and you can, the minute you get made by ICE, you have to stop connecting. And that happened to me. I had to stop providing the direct aid to some of the kids and families that I was helping because I had an interaction, nonverbal, through the window of my car, but enough to know, like, all right, I'm known now. So, which is just wild to even say out loud and to be scared of that. So that's one thing. The way that we've seen this play out just in our community, we've had, and this is, you know, just one story, we've had an individual who was kidnapped here legally, no criminal record, as is the case with most of our neighbors. And he got released out of state in the middle of the night with nothing and made his way back here. A friend ended up giving him a ride, but he arrived and he had been gone for long enough that he lost his job. He was behind on his rent because of it. No idea when he would get his job back, had no food in his fridge. Just people didn't know where he was for a while. This one person removed from their life created an entire cyclone of chaos and pain and trauma that just we're still helping with. And so I'm glad our network is here to be able to help meet whatever basic needs we can, including we've got practitioners that are willing to give online mental health help, actual medical appointments. People have banded together in what their niche is and what their area of expertise is in a way that that has been really beautiful to see. What I worry about is, how do I put this? It's odd to be talking about all of these things that we're doing because on my shoulder, over behind me is that idea in the back of my mind of, okay, we're giving away all our secrets. We're talking about things that that maybe we shouldn't be talking about.
Yeah.
But, we've talked about this as a group and we decided, you know what, no matter what, we have to, there are more of us than there are of them. And we have to say as much out loud as we can, because for the people who might hear this and have some less desirable purposes and want to cause trouble, that's a risk. But I think there's going to be more people that are helped by sharing the information. And I got connected with some organizers in Chicago who had also been part of this group that dispatched a little mini groups to help other cities get prepared and to respond, and we're in touch and they're happy to share. It's created this really amazing network that helped provide a little bit of security in a very unsecure environment.
No, that's great. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Amy DeBeck, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Castine, Julia Edwards with the South Portland Helps Mutual Aid Network, and Oliver Kaplan, associate professor at the Joseph Corbell School of Global and Political Affairs at the University of Denver. Our topic today is the constitutional crisis. What does civic courage look like? This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news at weru.org, and please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. Julia was just talking about risks profiles being out there, being sort of not out there. You talk a little bit about staying safe, digital security, some of the evolving practices. You might even say something about Signal, which some of our listeners may not even know what Signal is. So just get us started on this.
Yeah, well, this is an issue that, you know, civilians in war zones that are trying to organize face around the world. They're, you know, up against militaries or non-state groups that are trying to, you know, infiltrate their movements and stigmatize them and that kind of thing. And we've been seeing that, you know, in the U.S., not that it's the exact same type of war zone, but, you know, there are similar pressures. And so the communities themselves, they often take a number of different approaches to protect their members and their leaders. I mean, one of the things, you know, was just mentioned by both Amy and Julia is, you know, role differentiation. So, you know, moving people out of frontline roles, maybe to backbench roles, if you will, or sort of less public roles. Sometimes what they'll do is even rotate, you know, their leaders who are under threat or sort of hot at the moment. They'll rotate them out of the community to a bigger city with, you know, friends who are living there to keep them safe. And I think that sort of, you know, rotation of people, if things are difficult or people need to step away for whatever reason, you know, that kind of organizational resilience is really important. And then, yeah, a growing issue is the use of technology. I've written a little bit about the strategies that technology enables, from, you know, recording acts that are going on with a cell phone to digital fundraising, to mapping and other types of community organizing and networking. And those are all really important. I think, you know, the best practice right now is to be on an app like Signal, which is seen as more secure, and keep your device secure, things like that.
So it's a messaging app. Is that what it is?
Messaging app, yeah. Signal. Yeah, that you can sign up for. It's kind of like the iMessage that you use, but it's more encrypted. You can set up groups. That's sort of seen as more secure than WhatsApp at this. But I think, you know, there's a debate about, you know, is what WhatsApp really less secure? But I think, you know, people are converging on Signal in countries abroad. A lot of people use WhatsApp. And so, you know, one of the things that we see in the international context more than here is like internet shutdowns. And so that's a problem that, you know, makes it hard for people to communicate. In fact, in the protests that happened in Iran recently, there was a massive shutdown for quite a while. We're not quite seeing that type of, response in the U.S. And actually, you know, what we're seeing is something that surprised both me and my co-author of the article, who've been paying attention to these types of movements, which is really in the U.S. We have these big tech companies, and they've been involved in different ways. You know, one of which is removing, you know, certain apps that people have developed to monitor, you know, ICE operations and things like that from the app stores. And that was something that we hadn't seen to the moment in international context, where like people have developed different apps for early warning and monitoring airstrikes and things like that. But to think that like a tech company would be involved in taking that down was kind of shocking. The other thing that's coming out in the news this week, and maybe the other guests, you know, have had some familiarity with it, but this idea of like people who are running social media accounts, seeing, you know, subpoenas come in to large social media companies trying to identify, you know, sort of or intimidate maybe the owners of those types of accounts, and so that's sort of a new challenge that I think we're still kind of learning how to adapt to.
I read about those subpoenas going to Facebook and some of the others, and it sounded as though if they subpoenaed your information, the app owners were giving you notice that the government has subpoenaed your records, and you had so many days to file a challenge to the subpoena. And I'm just telling you what I read. It sounded like if you did challenge the subpoena, the government almost always dropped the case. But if you don't challenge it, am I getting this right?
That's what I read too. So I think, So respond, respond to it, pay attention. It's not clear what effect that's having, but I think the idea that there is pressure, responding to people's social media activity, which, in pretty much I would imagine most or all cases is, protected under our right to free speech. It's worrying.
Yeah. Now, Julia, when I invited you to come on the show and I said, do you want me to post a link to your webpage or whatever, you said, no, we don't do that. And I was wondering, as you on Signal, like, are people anonymous on Signal so that, even their coworkers don't know who they are?
For the most part, you can always tell who's new to some of the bigger channels that we have set up. And, they get hip to what's going on real quick of like, okay, change it so that, if there's like 10 Emilys, you might be okay to use your real name. But most people I'm seeing have changed. It's this really odd feeling of moving through my community in person and being in spaces where I know there are probably people that I'm communicating with and we don't know it, because we don't know our real names. And that's by design. It has to be that way. The safety and security piece of it, we had to build the plane while we were flying it, essentially. And that was really hard because we didn't know what's real. And we still don't really know what's real. We had people in our networks being told directly by ICE and CBP agents, congratulations, you're now on, a domestic terrorist list. And we don't really know what that means. We're going to assume that all of that is true and react accordingly. But, that the safety of ourselves is important, but more than that, the safety of the people that that we were and are helping was paramount to. So we just assumed that they were watching everything all the time. People bought Faraday bags and people put snow on their license plates when they were driving through some of the intersections.
Sorry, what's a Faraday bag?
It's a bag that you can put your phone or your device in that disables any signal and access to it. So you're not having to turn it off and on all the time, but it's like a blackout bag that you can seal up. And so those are becoming more popular. Disabling the facial recognition to open your phone, because that's how they would get access to the Signal chats. And then the whole thing comes crumbling.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. If they can open your phone, they can go anywhere they want.
Oh, yes.
So yeah, little things like that, we just tried to have. And our list became longer and longer of things to keep in mind if you're out delivering, if you're driving somebody, how to keep them safe, how to keep yourself safe, what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. We had people who had community members taken from their vehicle.
Now, yeah. Amy, I saw you nodding along pretty vigorously when we were talking about some of these measures. What's been your experience about personal and digital security?
It's probably my biggest growing edge in this area because I know that I'm on record. I was ministering during COVID, so I've got, 3 years of online sermons that state pretty clearly where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean I want to get taken. So I concentrate on making sure that I don't do anything that messes it up for someone else. I certainly hold my own safety as dear as I can, but I hold more dear people who, if I mention their name or post a picture of them or even talk about what I was doing for them, they could be endangered. So I'm not taking a lot of pictures lately. And that's specifically for safety because it could identify where I am or where somebody else is. It was weird for me to go to Signal and think, I've been on Signal for years, but to realize it isn't that they hacked the information, it's the interception of the broadcast. That's not something I thought would happen in my lifetime. That's something that I watch in movies.
Yeah.
And it's real. And I think that that's very hard to get across to general public, to general folks.
Yeah.
That's hard. So even when we're planning something, you want to put it on a flyer and put it all over town and make sure everybody knows, but also you don't want anyone to know.
Yeah, that's the edge, isn't it? You want everybody to know, but you don't want anyone to know. Yeah, go ahead, Oliver. I see you wanting to get
in
here.
I was going to say, this is such an important topic. And I think, you know, one of the overall takeaways is that there, you know, there really is safety in numbers to the extent that you can unify, well, you know, in some cases, keeping your information and contacts with others hidden. But, you know, I think like, you know, out on the street, like, you know, having a buddy system or going out with other people who you know, who, you know, in case something happens are there for you, you know, you're not alone. I think in some ways it transfers to the digital space. You know, the more people that are involved, it's harder, you know, the harder it is to for, you know, another group of individuals to follow and counter that. And so I think like, you know, having that out and then really kind of the countering stigma. I mean, there are a lot of terms that are being thrown around like agitator and domestic terrorist and things like that. And this is, actually, it happens in war zones all the time. People are stigmatized as being a member of the guerrillas or a member of the military or whatever, right? And there's always a struggle to kind of show people's true nonviolent nature. And, you know, through filming, for example, or community vouching, one for the other, especially people with, you know, a lot of credibility like reverends and spiritual leaders, I think is really important. So just to sort of put a pin on this, that this is just such an important topic for us to pay attention to.
Well, I mean, the topic of vouching, like you just said, and the extent to which we really only know what we know because people were there bearing witness and vouching for each other. It's pretty big. Somebody say something.
It was really the vouching piece really is how any of this has been successful, and I think how it's going to survive. We either had a waiting room of people that wanted to help, overwhelming numbers of people that were like, I heard, I can help. And if one of us in the core kind of organizers group didn't know them, we had to kind of track down, okay, what's the, in Maine, it's usually like 2 or 3 degrees of separation, but what's the 6 degrees of separation? And so, you know, when we're out like talking to people we know and trust, it was so lovely to be able to know, okay, my group trusts me. And so I can grab the 6 people that I know and directly connect them and plug them in so that they're ready and they're off and running today instead of having to wait. The vetting and the vouching was really powerful. And it also helped to like protect because there'd be some people that would come in the fold and sorry, this is not the space for you. Go for it. It was really, really important to have that. Like if I could, it only worked if you could look somebody in the eye, sometimes on Signal, but like on the video, but, and be like, yep, this person I'm sending you is golden. Put them anywhere they want to be. So
interesting. Yeah. All right. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Oliver Kaplan, Associate Professor at the Joseph Corbell School of Global and Public Affairs, the University of Denver, Amy DeBeck, Minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Castine, and Julia Edwards with the South Portland Helps Mutual Aid Network. This program was pre-recorded on February 16th. No listener calls are being taken. I want to spend the last segment of our conversation together talking about, I mean, we've kind of been talking about this the whole hour, but what can ordinary people do? You know, people are going to be listening to this show on the radio. What are the public policy initiatives we should be following? What are the personal preparations we can be making? What should civic organizations like the League be doing to prepare? What can we do to help and support? And Oliver, I'll let you go first because you've got the broadest experience across, well, the world and across the country. Like, how do people get ready for this? And how do they react to it? What are the preparations?
This is a tough one. I think there are times when, you know, people kind of aren't ready and have to organize on the fly. And I think, you know, what we're seeing, especially with the co-panelists, is organizing at least based on some existing network or organization. And so it could be a church, for example, which, you know, isn't, the purpose of a church is not to do any kind of, you know, resistance or nonviolent action, but it is a network. It has an important moral authority. as well, and it has people who are committed. It adheres to nonviolent principles and love thy neighbor and all that stuff. And I think that that's an important kind of infrastructure. Similarly, Julia's group of people from that you might know from a school or groups of mothers or whoever it is, these people that have these pre-existing social ties, that kind of community building is important. I think in the U.S., what is a little less common is powerful neighborhood associations. That's true in some places, like in Denver or in California. There are sort of fairly strong associations where I am, but I also know that just it's not as common a thing. Whereas in rural Afghanistan, to rural Colombia, to rural communities in Africa, there are very strong community structures still in place. Not everywhere, they vary, but that's another sort of way of organizing. And we've seen sort of some of these neighborhood associations at the very local level doing different nonviolent actions for mutual aid, to putting up barricades, to things like that. And so, that kind of structure has maybe withered a bit in the U.S. And I think we're seeing now how important that type of sort of know your neighbor, right? Like that kind of thing. And I think, beyond that, I would say, in general sense, paying attention, following what's happening, being aware, and starting to do some of these trainings, to know how, some of the technical things that procedures that Julia is talking about. Like, I haven't done those yet, so I don't know how some of that works, but there are people that do and that are learning it. And I think slowly distributing some of those practices, and those practices will evolve. I think, what we saw in each city has been slightly different, and going forward, things may be different, and it may not even be ICE. It might be some other challenge that people are facing. And so I think trying to stay nimble, but build these best practices and realize that, we're in a situation of, to an extent, crumbling rule of law, and court orders from judges not being followed, and those types of situations, and Congress not being super functional right now. And so what I think that means is that, the people have to think about what kind of society do we want, and uphold practices of nonviolence and practices of coexistence and peaceful norms and, all those types of things. And it's, to be honest, it's a little crazy to have to think about having to say this about our country, about America. I think in war zones, it's kind of a more common thing where the situations are crumbling and you have to, the citizens are the last backstop for themselves. I'm not saying that there aren't any other actions people can take. There's certainly legal actions and laws, attempts to pass laws and politicians who are speaking out. But I think the community organizing is really playing an important role. I think that's what we've seen. So
go ahead, Julia.
I was reflecting on your question, Anne, and Oliver's comments, and what we've seen in a very short time. I mean, it's been 4 weeks, I think, five since the rumor started here in Maine, at least. And it was, whiplash of activity. And now we are in the stage of trying to figure out, okay, what does this look like? We've built this thing and it's amazing and impactful. And how do we respond to other threats, to other issues around safety for any vulnerable populations or marginalized peoples? And so we have some ideas about that, and are not going away, which is great. We've had sort of this realization as a community in some sense that the way our city is organized and laid out, for instance, how zoning policies and affordable housing policies and where people in marginalized populations are concentrated in our city is a deliberate choice over time. We are segregated, and it is down to everything about how our schools are populated, and how our redistricting or our districting happens. And so we're getting more people to wake up to that intentional design in all those ways. And it means people are showing up to city council. Are we pleasant? Are we happy? Not always, but we're showing up in ways that I don't think that the council was prepared for. And now we're there. So same with school board meetings and just getting engaged in conversations to really try and address the root cause of why we have such vulnerable, why is it that one side of my city is where everyone was trying to get to help people, and the other side had no ICE activity whatsoever. Like, that's problematic. So yeah. It's woken up a lot of local advocacy and threads that bind a lot of issues that some people didn't realize before this traumatic event and experience. So,
well, I guess that has to do with get to know your neighbor and get to know your community too. So mm-hmm. what would you like to say to that? What can people who are hearing this conversation take away from it in terms of their personal mm-hmm. actions, Amy? Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make sure that I said on this program, don't forget about singing. Don't forget about when you hear that somebody has a group started of resistant singing. Yeah, it's a church thing. But when you're out there and all of you are singing together, it de-escalates the tension and you hear it with your heartbeat. And so that's something done in community. It's fine if one person goes out and does it, but when everybody is doing it together, that's such a peaceful, nonviolent action that can change things big time on the ground. So I wanted to make sure I said that. And the other thing about knowing your neighbor is when I came back, I had a Zoom meeting right away with my sisters. And I needed for them to understand one lives in Richmond, Virginia, one lives near Dulles Airport, and one lives near National Airport. And so pretty urban areas, but suburban also. And I needed to let them know that that things are different. Like I went to Minneapolis, I saw it, I understand it, and I needed for them to know that things are different. And they took a stand that I think a lot of people are of, I want to do whatever I can to keep my neighbor safe. And what I'm saying is all of us need to be doing this for all of us so that we can all have the country that we want. And it's a moral thing. It's not a political thing. It's not like, you know, which party are you or which religion are you? Or it's a moral problem that that we're all facing together.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. We're almost out of time this afternoon, and I promised you each a minute at the end to sort of wrap us up, and I'm going to give you that time now. What are your parting thoughts for people who are listening in? And let me ask you first, Julia.
I think for me, making a choice to stay engaged and be open to having what that engagement looks like change depending on what's happening and who else comes into the group with other strengths, and really putting egos aside. 100%, they get checked at the door. We've seen some signal chats in other towns kind of melt down because of communication or lack thereof. And luckily, we have not experienced that yet. There's just there's a need for a very intentional respect for that we're all there for a reason, and that has to be central. That reason has to stay central. And if that reason is not served, it move along. I think too, the interconnectivity of so much of our the way our society is organized, and here on the local level in South Portland, but I would argue other places in the country too, paying attention to that and kind of asking, well, how did we get here? And how can we not stay here is important. And so I just would really encourage anyone that is struggling to find a tangible way to help. Maybe your lane is engaging in conversation with your town or city about affordable housing or about housing policy or public assistance or how your schools are organized. What's the demographic breakdown of your schools? Where are the socioeconomically disadvantaged people in your city or town? Start there and really look at how you've organized yourselves as a city. And then from there, you'll find where you want to fit and where your energy is best placed. And don't feel bad if you can't do it all or don't feel like you're good at there's everything helps.
Thank you, Julia.
Yeah.
Let me give Amy a shot. Final words.
Maine is one big, small town. Wherever you go, you're going to find good people and people who challenge you, and they're all your neighbors.
Yeah.
And we're going to discover a lot as we're resisting with courage and love and nonviolence. We're going to find out a lot that we didn't know. And may we all be full of heart to handle the things that we find out, because while we're out there helping, we find out a lot of things we didn't know, like the socioeconomic problems. We learn about ourselves. We learn about our privilege when we see people who don't have the same. And I look forward to moving together.
Thank you, Amy. Last word to you, Oliver.
Great. Thanks so much. I think that like in war zones around the world, protection and protecting life isn't political. And that's sort of what our co-panelists have also said, and I think that they're trying, the forces that be are trying to make it political. And I think in that context, it's just so important to keep any kind of social movements nonviolent, and also to remember that not all nonviolence is protest. That's the most visible thing we see, but there are so many other actions and ways to get involved, from singing to, giving rides to everything else. But I think right now, at this moment, based on what people are seeing, people are rightly emotional and angry about what's going on. But I think it's also really important to avoid giving pretexts for additional violence or crackdowns. And the way to do that is to keep it nonviolent. So.
Yeah, that's great. That's our show for today. Thank you to our guests this afternoon, Oliver Kaplan, Associate Professor, the Joseph Corbell School of Global and Public Affairs at the University of Denver, Amy DeBeck, Minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Castine, and Julia Edwards, the South Portland Mutual Aid Network. We've been talking about the constitutional crisis. What does civic courage look like now? And the message is basically nonviolence, protection, organization, and people power. And we're going to take that conversation with us into tomorrow. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a program of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM, streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League of Women Voters is at lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in this series. You can subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here next month.